Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the October 6th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Healthy Ways to Deal with Anger. Rage is So Taboo by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. Facebook, Former Worker Wants Oversight by Marcy Gordon and Barbara Ortute, the Associated Press. Rural Colorado, Three Students Craft Bill to Get Their Teachers at Least 40K by Jason Gonzalez, Chalkbeat, Colorado. Healthy Ways to Deal with Anger. Rage is So Taboo. Coloradans look to counseling, activism, and smashing things by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. Ashley Garcia tossed a white plate in the air like a baseball, cracking the dinnerware with a bat into a confetti spray of ceramic shards. A primal scream surged out of Garcia's core. Giggles and maniacal cackles followed. I'm having waves of emotion, Garcia said. I'm feeling so many feelings, I had no idea. On Friday afternoon, Garcia, 33, and two of her friends proceeded to shatter, wallop, crush, beat, splinter, and otherwise pulverize a room full of breakables with the help of a sledgehammer, bat, and crowbar. They delivered blow after blow to a wooden dresser. They obliterated a vacuum cleaner. They clobbered a Dwight Yoakam cassette tape, then paraded around the room with entrails of tape ribbon in their fingers. They wept. They laughed. They wiped away sweat beads. They cheered after crashing, bashing, cacophony. The destruction, while real, was sanctioned. The trio of friends from Denver and Durango booked an outing to Smash It Break Room, a so-called rage room in Denver, where people looking to blow off steam pay to suit up in protective gear, pick from a selection of damaging tools, and get ushered into a room set up to be torn apart with supervision. On a recent bike ride, Garcia's thoughts began to wander to the state of the world. She found herself overcome unexpectedly with a rage so forceful she burst into tears. It almost felt like I was storing rage in my body and the pedaling awakened it and let it out, Garcia said. She's not alone. Cody Mitz, a licensed counselor who offers anger management therapy in Denver, said the events of the past couple of years, political turmoil, an amplified spotlight on racism, a still raging pandemic, financial distress, climate grief, have ensured the group therapy sessions at Ipsetti Counseling Clinic have remained full. A lot more people are seeking out support of their anger, Mitz said. We've stayed busier in the last couple of years with everything going on in the world. A lot of people are looking for healthy ways to express their anger right now. Whether it's through rage rooms, therapy, wellness activities such as meditation and exercise, or channeling anger into activism, many Coloradans are in search of better ways for the mind and body to cope with feeling, with seething, searing fire inside them. Righteous Rage. Hasira Sol Ashemu said his name means righteous rage in Swahili. The Denver community organizer, son of Lauren Watson, who founded Denver's Black Panther Party, created the Righteous Rage Institute, a Denver-based social justice organization offering education, training, and healing resources to help turn people's anger into activism. We all experience frustration and rage, as Shimu said. What really is at the root of that rage is that there are systems that are failing people, and that is why many people have articulated what we've gone through in the last 2 years as a dual pandemic. The virus, but then the weaknesses in our systems and virus expose the social system, housing, justice system, financial systems. People have been a collateral damage to the failing of those systems. We help people to articulate and to transform that raw rage into righteous rage. Rage that can help them to transform themselves, their families, their communities, the nation, and the world. The Righteous Rage Institute holds free Saturday educational sessions called Freedom School that teach Denver Public Schools students culturally relevant curriculum and allow parents to meet and form support groups among themselves. The organization also hosts healing cohorts at which community leaders and activists entrenched in heavy social issues can decompress and learn to care for themselves as well as their communities. Ashimu likens rage to the way we feel upon stepping on a tack. It's a healthy response of your psyche, Ashimu said. It alerts your nervous system that there is something amiss. There is nothing wrong with rage in and of itself, but if you don't move your toe, you'll continue to be injured. In addition to negatively impacting personal and professional relationships, Mitt said long-term anger problems can lead to health issues such as high blood pressure and heart problems. The licensed therapist said if minor inconveniences are eliciting explosive or lasting feelings of anger, it may be a sign of an anger problem that could use professional help. Rage is alerting you that there's an issue and telling you that you have the power to transform it, Ashimu said. You don't have to be a victim of stepping on tacks. You can build a better shoe. It's such a release. Galena Espinoza, president and editor-in-chief of pro-reproductive rights and sexual health news publication Rewire News Group, said she wanted to foster community among the publication's audience after a period of terrible news, culminating in the U.S. Supreme Court's May announcement that the court would weigh in on a Mississippi abortion law intended to challenge Roe versus Wade. Espinosa decided that hosting a live stream and fundraising event in Colorado based Rewire editors and podcast hosts Jessica Mason Piclo and Imana Gandhi took out their frustrations at the Smash It break room while viewers lived vicariously through them would be an out-of-box way to express rage in a safe environment. Piclo and Gandhi read quotes and policies about abortion and then smashed breakables live on camera. We didn't want folks to be feeling scared and defenseless, and what better way to signal that than to give two legal journalists a sledgehammer to take to all those terrible decisions and rulings and inaccuracies about basic reproductive biology, Espinosa said. It really hit such an empowering chord. There was literal power in what they were doing. It was not only funny to watch them, but it really was very inspiring. We can fight back and we can have power. It was incredible to see. If breaking things isn't your cup of tea, Ashimu said, taking some time for introspection to figure out what healthy activities make you feel good and building those things into your life is key to resilience in the face of rage. Those include things like meditation, yoga, drinking enough clean water, and eating enough clean food so our bodies, minds, and souls are set for the challenges we're going to face, Ashimu said. Some people get relaxed by going to a body of water. Some like going on a bike ride. A lot of us know what makes us enrage, but what brings me peace? Do that. Dustin Gagne, owner of Smash It Break Room, said his business has hosted its fair share of divorce parties, therapists and their clients, and commemorations mourning a loved one, along with fun events like birthdays and corporate events. The business partners with local thrift stores to acquire its soon-to-be smashed goods and allows patrons to buy packages where they get to break more items for longer periods of time. Rage is so taboo, said Garcia, passing off a sledgehammer to her friend, that everybody feels it. You don't get to Hulk out in public, but here I have permission. Hearing that smash, it's such a release. I feel great now. Facebook, former worker wants oversight. Company's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. Haugen testifies by Marcy Gordon and Barbara Ortute, the Associated Press. While accusing the giant social network of pursuing profits over safety, a former Facebook data scientist told Congress Tuesday she believes stricter government oversight could alleviate the dangers the company poses, from harboring children to inciting political violence to fueling misinformation. Frances Haugen, testifying to the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, presented a wide-ranging condemnation of Facebook. She accused the company of failing to make changes to Instagram after internal research showed apparent harm to some teens and being dishonest in its public fight against hate and misinformation. Haugen's accusations were buttressed by tens of thousands of pages of internal research. The outage. Facebook says a cascade of mistakes were made during maintenance. The documents she secretly copied before leaving her job in the company's civic integrity unit. But she also offered thoughtful ideas about how Facebook's social media platforms could be made safer. Haugen laid responsibility for the company's profits over safety strategy right at the top with CEO Mark Zuckerberg, but she also expressed empathy for Facebook's dilemma. Haugen, who says she joined the company in 2019 because Facebook has the potential to bring out the best in us, said she didn't leak internal documents to a newspaper and then come before Congress to order to destroy the company or call for its breakup, as many consumer advocates and lawmakers of both parties have called for. Haugen is a 37-year-old data expert from Iowa with a degree in computer engineering and master's degree in business from Harvard. Prior to being recruited by Facebook, she worked for 15 years at tech companies, including Google, Pinterest, and Yelp. Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy, Haugen said. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. Congressional action is needed, she said. They won't solve this crisis without your help. Democrats and Republicans have shown a rare unity around the revelations of Facebook's handling of potential risks to teens from Instagram, and bipartisan bills have proliferated to address social media and data privacy problems. But getting legislation through Congress is a heavy slog. The Federal Trade Commission has taken a stricter stance towards Facebook and other tech giants in recent years. Whenever you have Republicans and Democrats on the same page, you're probably more likely to see something, said Gautam Hans, a technology, law, and free speech expert at Vanderbilt University. Haugen suggested, for example, that the minimum age for Facebook's popular Instagram photo sharing platform could be increased from the current 13 to 16 or 18. She also acknowledged that the limitations of possible remedies, Facebook, like other social media companies, uses algorithms to rank and recommend content to users' news feeds. When ranking is based on engagement, likes, shares, and comments, as it is now with Facebook, users can be vulnerable to manipulation and misinformation. Haugen would prefer the ranking to be chronological, but she testified, people will choose the more addictive option even if it's leading their daughters to eating disorders. Haugen said a 2018 change to the content flow contributed to more divisiveness and ill will in a network ostensibly created to bring people closer together. Despite the anonymity that the new algorithms were feeding, she said Facebook found that they help keep people coming back. A pattern that helped the social media giant sell more of the digital ads that generate the vast majority of its revenue. Haugen said she believed Facebook didn't set out to build a destructive platform. I have a huge amount of empathy for Facebook, she said. These are really hard questions, and I think they feel a little trapped and isolated. But in the end, the buck stops with Mark, Haugen said, referring to Zuckerberg, who controls more than 50% of Facebook's voting shares. There is no one currently holding Mark accountable but himself. Haugen said she believed that Zuckerberg was familiar with some of the internal research showing concerns for potential negative impacts of Instagram. The subcommittee is examining Facebook's use of information its own researchers compiled about Instagram. Those filings could indicate potential harm for some of its young users, especially girls, although Facebook publicly downplayed possible negative impacts. For some of the teens devoted to Facebook's popular photo sharing platform, the peer pressure generated by the visually focused Instagram led to mental health and body image problems, and in some cases, eating disorders and suicidal thoughts, the research leaked by Haugen showed. One internal study cited 13.5% of teen girls saying Instagram makes thoughts of suicide worse, and 17% of teen girls saying it makes eating disorders worse. She also has filed complaints with federal authorities alleging that Facebook's own research shows that it amplifies hate, misinformation, and political unrest, but that the company hides what it knows. After recent reports in the Wall Street Journal based on documents she leaked to the newspaper raised a public outcry, Haugen revealed her identity in CBS 60 Minutes interview aired Sunday night. As the public relations debacle over Instagram research grew last week, Facebook put on hold its work on a kids' version of Instagram, which the company says is meant mainly for tweens aged 10 to 12. Haugen said that Facebook prematurely turned off safeguards designed to thwart misinformation and incitement to violence after Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump in last year's presidential election, alleging that doing so contributed to the deadly January 6th assault on U.S. Capitol. After the November election, Facebook dissolved the Civic Integrity Unit where Haugen had been working. That was the moment, she said, when she realized that I don't trust that they're willing to actually invest what needs to be invested to keep Facebook from being dangerous. Haugen says she told Facebook executives when they recruited her that she wanted to work in an area of the company that fights misinformation because she had lost a friend to online conspiracy theories. Facebook maintains that Haugen's allegations are misleading and insists there is no evidence to support the premise that it is the primary cause of social polarization. Today, a Senate Commerce Subcommittee held a hearing with a former product manager at Facebook who worked for the company for less than 2 years, had no direct reports, never attended a decision point meeting with top executives, and testified more than six times to not working on the subject matter in question. We don't agree with her characterization of the many issues she testified about, the company said in a statement. Rural Colorado, three students craft bill to get their teachers at least $40,000 by Jason Gonzalez, Chalkbeat, Colorado. Malcolm Lovejoy's high school in Campo hasn't had a math teacher since he was a freshman. The rural school was able to finally hire a math teacher this school year, Lovejoy said. But the 17-year-old senior feels very behind in his math skills, and adding to concerns about his education this year, the high school's English teacher left, moving away from the remote plains town near the Oklahoma border. In rural towns like Campo, finding and keeping teachers who want to stay and can survive on the low pay can be difficult. Campo School District RE-6 starts beginning teachers at $27,500 a year, but then those with a master's degree and 10 years of experience make just $34,600. Lovejoy said most Campo teachers could make more working at a local grocery or convenience store. That's not really many reasons for teachers to live in this area, Lovejoy said. And if our school can't really pay them anything, then what's their reason to be there? In an attempt to change how much teachers get paid in Campo and rural areas across the state, Lovejoy and two other rural high school students, along with the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs professor and graduate student, crafted legislation they hope will set a new bar for salaries. The proposal would raise the minimum salary for Colorado rural teachers to $40,000 a year, with the state supplementing local funds for those salaries. The group hopes the extra money would encourage rural teachers to stay in the state's smallest communities. Altogether, the bill could benefit 6,000 teachers and cost the state an estimated $35 million a year to supplement salaries. The legislation doesn't have many sponsors yet, but the group is hoping to secure backing from members of both parties. State Senator Rachel Zinsinger, an Arvada Democrat who leads the Senate Education Committee, said she hasn't seen the draft legislation, but she expects the proposal to face an uphill battle. No statewide minimum salary. About half of U.S. states set a minimum teacher salary. Colorado does not, and leaves it to each district to set pay schedules. Rural schools, however, lack the tax base to raise money for teacher salaries, and the Colorado legislature already can't cover its financial obligations to schools under the state constitution. Last year, a new law created a special fund from which districts could request money to raise salaries, but there's no money in the fund. Robert Mitchell, a CU Colorado Springs assistant professor, said rural teachers often say that pay determines whether they stay in a community. Mitchell, who also teaches part-time in Campo, said educators in rural areas often teach because they love the job, but they also are forced to make hard decisions. Teachers will work long hours and then work their ranch or farm. Others work a second job to stay afloat. Neither group can survive on only a teacher's salary, he said. We need to do something about it, Mitchell said. I mean, we're getting outpaced in salary by places like Loaf and Jug and 7-Eleven. In Colorado, teachers make an average about $51,000 a year. Among just rural districts, Mitchell said, the average salary dips dramatically. Some rural school districts start teachers at about $25,000 a year. In Campo, it can take more than 20 years of experience to earn $40,000 a year, according to the district's salary schedule. Colorado lawmakers have tried to attract teachers through laws that give thousands of dollars in student loan forgiveness to educators relocating to rural areas. But Campo, with its years-long search for a math teacher, illustrates how difficult it can be to attract teachers despite incentives. Campo Superintendent Nikki Johnson said no qualified applicants applied for the math teacher job for several years. The district eventually hired a teacher who teaches on campus part-time and remotely part-time, Johnson said. The Campo School Board has asked the Colorado Association of School Boards to support the bill because of how difficult it has been to attract teachers. Johnson said the passage of the law wouldn't necessarily level the playing field because of the district's location, but it could at least allow teachers, especially those just starting out in their career, to consider a move to rural Colorado. It's going to continue to be a challenge, Johnson said, but at least it will get people to consider rural options. Once they're willing to consider it, then I think we can sell the community and the school district. Start of a larger conversation? Christy McCann, a CU Colorado Springs instructor, said teacher pay needs more attention and resources. She noted Colorado lawmakers last year created the educator pay fund without any revenue sources. McCann said the bill to create a minimum salary would help provide actual funding to address what she needs as a dire situation. She hopes the bill can represent the start of a larger conversation about how much teachers need to live in rural areas. Without this bill being passed, we're going to continue to hear stories of students who had to rely on remote learning from people that they've never met or who have lost teachers, she said. And what happens to those students if they're looking for social mobility, if they're wanting to go to a university? Other rural Colorado students also share in the concerns. Last school year, half of Elbert High School's teaching staff resigned, said senior Elizabeth Peterson, who helped craft the bill. The seven teachers who left the rural high school about an hour northeast of Colorado Springs, included a mentor who helped Peterson through her most trying moments. He was a teacher who offered me a room in his house when I was going through rough times, Peterson said. I don't think I'll ever find another teacher like that. The turnover, Peterson said, could have been avoided. The pay at rural schools forces teachers to struggle and causes students to worry about their future, she said. We will get a better education if we pay our teachers, Peterson said. You can't have future employees out of my generation if we don't have a good education. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Elsie Lorena Akala Baldwin, 101, of Denver, Colorado, went to be with her Lord on September 29, 2021 in Littleton, Colorado. Funeral services will be held on Friday, October 8th, 10 a.m. at Olinger Hamden Mortuary and Cemetery, 8600 East Hamden Avenue, Denver, Colorado, 80231. Sherman Aldrin Cowdrey, September 5th, 1932 to September 29th, 2021, Lieutenant Colonel, retired U.S. Army. Lieutenant Colonel, retired Sherman Aldrin Cowdrey, 89, passed away Wednesday, September 29, 2021, in Denver, Colorado. He was born September 5, 1932, in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, the son of C. Francis Cowdrey Jr. and Florence Aldrin Cowdrey. Sherman graduated from Wilbraham Academy in Wilbraham, Massachusetts, in 1950, and from Norwich University, the Military College of Vermont, in 1954, and entered active duty service in the United States Army. He met his sweetheart and wife-to-be, Janet Lucia, of West Hartford, Connecticut, at United Airlines, where she worked as a reservation agent. Sherman's military assignments took the couple to Germany, Taiwan, and throughout the United States. Following his military service, he worked as a civilian employee for the federal government in hospitality services and financial management. Surviving, in addition to his beloved wife of 65 years, Janet Cowdrey, and his brother William D. Cowdrey, and his wife Jackie Cowdrey, and his nephew Stephen A. Brockett, and his niece Elizabeth L. Malley. He was predeceased by his parents and his sister Cynthia Cowdrey Brockett. Sherman enjoyed the distinctions of being a Mayflower descendant of John Alden and the grandnephew of James Naismith, the inventor of the sport of basketball. Known for his keen intellect and love of learning, Sherman had a warm-hearted personality and loved and treated everyone with the utmost respect. He was truly a model officer and gentleman. A memorial mass will be held for Sherman on Thursday, October 7th, 2021 at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary Catholic Church on 6853 South Prince Street in Littleton, Colorado. Helen D. Furlong, April 27, 1925 to September 28, 2021. Wife, mother, volunteer Helen D. Furlong died on September 28, 2021. She was 96. She is preceded in death by her beloved husband, Ken. She is survived by her daughters, Karen Child, husband, Joseph, and grandchildren, Kathleen and Drew, Lucy Smith, Patricia Furlong, grandson, Jacob, and Susan Fisher, husband, Rob. Helen was born in Chicago Heights, Illinois, on April 27, 1925, the fourth child of Anna Mary Hibbert DeJitz and William Harrison Bates DeJitz. She was the first woman in her family to receive a bachelor's degree, graduating from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, with a degree in business administration. Helen met Ken on a blind date in Cincinnati, Ohio. 9 months later, the two married. Their 73-year-long love affair endured beyond Ken's death in July 2021. After raising four daughters, Helen discovered her love of Indigenous American art and history. She volunteered as a docent in the Indigenous Arts of North America department at the Denver Art Museum for nearly 20 years. She especially enjoyed seeing the spark of interest light up the eyes of children as she explained a piece of art. Helen was a devoted fan of the Colorado Rockies. The fans of Section 105 were perennial friends. Until her very last day, she knew exactly what time the game would be on TV. Remembrance donations may be made to the Arvada Center for the Arts and Humanities. A funeral service will be held at Spirit of Christ Catholic Church, 7400 West 80th Avenue, Arvada, on October 19th, 2021 at 11:30 a.m. A private burial will take place at Fort Logan National Cemetery. A full obituary can be found at horancares.com/obits. Sean Kelly, July 7, 1955 to September 4, 2021. Sean Kelly, a Denver native, died of sepsis in Austin, Texas on September 4, 2021. He was 66 years old. Sean was a musician and piano technician in Denver and moved to Austin in 2009. He is survived by three siblings, Norden Kelly, Nora Kelly, and Thomas Kelly. Connie Olmsted Jr., May 3, 1933 to December 11, 2020. 87 years old, memorial service, Saturday, October 9th, 1 p.m., Trinity Lutheran Church, 2200 Broadway, Boulder. Elva Olson, August 25th, 1929 to September 29th, 2021. 92 years old, passed away September 29, 2021, survived by Linda Olson Stuchlik and Tina Olson, Ed Kincaid, three grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren. Services to be held Tuesday, October 12, 2021, 9:30 a.m., Olinger Crown Hill Pavilion, Wheat Ridge. For full obituary, online at crownhillfuneral.com. Julia Julie McKendry, February 28, 1937 to October 3, 2021, a realtor. Age 84, passed away at Lutheran Hospice, surrounded by her family on Sunday, October 3, 2021. She was born at St. Anthony's Hospital in Denver in 1937 to parents Paul and Glenda Cheney. Julie met her husband, Bob, when they were 5 years old, and after being formally acquainted in the fourth grade, their friendship grew and eventually blossomed into a beautiful romance. They were married on June 8, 1957, and began growing their lives together. She graduated from Metropolitan State University in Denver in 1977 with a BA in elementary education and taught third grade for 2 years before starting her career in real estate. She was a successful real estate broker for 22 years, working for both REMAX and Metro Brokers. Despite all of her successes, she would say that her children were her greatest accomplishment and a dream come true. Julie loved spending time around people and visiting the mountains. She spent the majority of her time caring for her family and giving back to the community. You could always find her and Bob on their back patio overlooking their beloved lake. Julie is survived by her husband, Bob, her children, Bill, Ann, husband, Kat, Tom, wife, Chris, Brad, wife, Patty, her grandchildren, Hannah, husband, John, Tony, wife, Amy, Katie, Nick, wife Brielle and her sister Paula. Julie always said, "I wish life was like a football game. It would last forever." Her impact on the hearts and lives of those around her will, in fact, last forever. Funeral services will be held at St. Anne's Catholic Church in Arvada on Friday, October 8, 2021 at 10 a.m. Interment to follow in Mount Olivet Cemetery. A celebration of her life and reception will be held at Mount Olivet Reception Hall. All are welcome. For more information, please visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Jean Allison Melville, 1924 to August 30th, 2021. Jean was born in 1924 to Merle and Chuck Allison and had experienced two-thirds of Denver history by the time her peaceful passing at age 97 at her Denver home on August 30, 2021. Jean, brother Charles, Chud, Chuck, and her parents weathered the Great Depression while living in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood. It was here that Jean first began building forever friendships. Her uncanny ability to quickly connect with and then strike up new lasting friendships was evidenced in every decade of her life. When she wasn't learning piano from her mother or going to harness races at City Park with her grandfather, Jean especially enjoyed playing kick the can with the neighbor boys, included notably Max. The YMCA summer camp on Lookout Mountain fed her love of nature, as did weekend ski trips to Berthoud Pass, Rope Tow, or Winter Park, T-Bar. Following in the footsteps of her mother, class of 1918, Jean graduated from East High School in 1942 and headed west to Scripps College as a music major. Summers were spent supporting the war effort, driving trucks, delivering B-17 bomber parts, and working on teletype newsroom at Fitzsimmons Army Hospital with the American Women's Voluntary Service, AWVS. After her graduation and a vacation trip to Havana, Cuba with friends, Jean moved to New York City to work in the copyright department of Carl Fisher Music Publishers. Briefly back in Denver in 1947, she became reacquainted with Max Melville, her former kick-the-can buddy. Smitten, Max enrolled in Cornell University to be closer to Jean, eventually convincing her to take the 9-hour train ride up from New York City for spring weekend. They were married in the winter of 1948, launching 64 years of beautiful devotion to one another that lasted until Max's death in 2013. Max wore many hats, and Jean was a mostly willing partner in all of his adventures, serving as ranch hand, bookkeeper, secretary, and always a loving co-parent. Jean had a career of her own as the attendance clerk at Smiley and Gove Junior High Schools from 1967 through 1989. 10 and even 20 years following her retirement, we still encounter Gove alumni who remember her fondly. Do you remember your school attendance clerk? Whether battling blizzards on trips to the outhouse of their South Park ranch while pregnant with daughter Meredith or savoring a Denver Symphony performance, Jean's timeless elegance and perfect blend of grace and sophistication belied her feisty hardiness. A talented pianist, ruthless card player, and lover of music and nature, Jean's deepest and greatest love was her family. Compassionate, caring, and nurturing, unless she was sitting across a cribbage board, she avidly followed and wonderfully chronicled the lives of her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and crafted beautiful volumes on our Allison and Melville ancestors. Jean is survived by her children Meredith, husband Rick Hackett, Steve, husband Terry and Brian, grandchildren Jesse, wife Draney, Tracy and Cotter, wife Kira, and great-grandchildren Melanie, Madison, and Marcus. A public celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. on October 16, 2021, under the outdoor gazebo at Windsor Gardens, 595 South Clinton Street, Denver. Donations in Gene's name would be greatly appreciated by the Colorado Symphony Guild. In honor of her many years of service to the Guild or Ars Nova Singers of Boulder, her favorite vocal performance group. Dorothy Urban, March 12, 1933 to October 1st, 2021. Viewing will be held at 1 p.m. Monday, October 11, 2021 at Archdiocese of Denver Mortuary. Mass will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, October 11, 2021. Burial will follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Helen Ann Von Austin, July 27, 1934 to September 21, 2021. Helen Von Austin, whom lived a long life of loving kindness, passed away in New Mexico on Tuesday, September 21, 2021. She was a loving mother to Catherine and Stephen, an affectionate and compassionate grandmother to four, a great grandmother to three, and a smiling friend to all she knew and met. Helen was born in Ottawa, Illinois in 1934. She was a devoted wife to Norbert von Austin for 63 years. Helen worked as a purchasing agent at the Rocky Mountain newspaper for 35 years. She lived her adult life in Denver, Colorado, and spent the last 2 years in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. A celebration of her life will be held in the Denver metro area in the spring of 2022. Dates and times will be forthcoming. Please visit herancares.com to leave memories and condolences on her online obituary tribute wall. Richard Weil, 73, died on September 29th from complications related to treatment for acute myeloid leukemia. Beloved husband of Zareen, father of Aaron, wife Linda Perry, Darius and Delna, brother of Kathy, husband Robert Jervis, and uncle of Alexa, husband Greg Rax Jervis, Lisa, husband Jay Schwartz and Jervis, Myra Baina, and Layla Baina, son of the late Betty Lou and William Weil of Denver, Colorado. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in Richard's memory to the Kelly Writers House Endowment Fund or the Sierra Club. Maureen Williams, April 15, 1945 to July 6, 2021. Maureen was born in Iowa to parents Paul and Ruth Kellogg, both deceased. In early childhood, Maureen lived in many places because her father was in the military. Maureen graduated from Aurora High School and then St. Luke's Nursing School. Maureen began her nursing career at St. Luke's Hospital, later worked in claims for CAN and Cigna insurance companies. Survivors are husband Rockford Williams, sister Mary Kirby, husband John, brothers Michael Kellogg, wife Debbie, and Patrick Kellogg, wife Kathy. Maureen inherited seven children: Adrian Richwell, Rockford Williams Jr., deceased; Diana Williams, Douglas Williams, and Jeffrey Williams; two stepdaughters, Sue Armstrong, husband Mark, Barbara Murzewski, husband Kevin, also survived by 11 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. Maureen was friends with everyone, a caregiver for many and missed by all. Maureen died from complications from Guillain-Barre syndrome, GBS. Donations to GBS/CIPD Foundation, 375 Elm Street, Conshohocken, Pennsylvania, 19428. Celebration of Life, Friday, October 15th, 2021. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Intoxicating sounds. Records, Highballs on the Menu at Denver's First Japanese-Style Listing Room by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. The way Will Mintner describes his first experience with Japan's listing cafe culture is just magical. The Lion Cafe is a two-story shrine to classical music set in Tokyo's trend-setting Shibuya Ward. Its original 1920s speakers stood around 8 feet tall and atop their own altar. Listeners sat before a grand sound system in church-like pews and listened to records silently, almost in reverence. You go in, it's like a library. This is a very studious, quiet environment, Mintner explained. Usually the older the listening room was, the more of that energy it had. Now Mintner and his business partner, Mitch Foster, are trying to recreate some of their favorite moments from Lion and other listening cafes they visited in 2019 at a new all-day cafe and bar, ESP Hi-Fi, at 1029 Santa Fe Drive in Denver. They've watched vinyl-playing rooms such as Sheep's Clothing in Los Angeles and Bambino in Paris make their own marks on this subset of cafe culture. By 2019 in Denver, Sunday Vinyl had started serving wine and dinner and turning up nightly set lists curated by a local record club. These types of listening cafes started cropping up in Japan after World War II as Japanese culture welcomed an influx of Western music traditions. More recently, they are gaining traction in Europe and the U.S. Foster and Mintner added their own touches to this small analog revolution. At their well-hidden ESP along Denver's Art District on Santa Fe, oil lamps cast a warm glow on the wood tables and bar surface. A lifelike stereo sound fills the main seating area with two sets of speakers facing listeners either at the bar or in the sitting room. At the focal point of the cafe, which boasts $20,000 worth of turntable equipment alone, is two refurbished Bartop Girard 401 turntables, workhorses in the hi-fi world, made famous when the BBC started using them in the middle of the last century to broadcast tunes 24/7. Between the players is an Australian Condesa mixer designed for blending and slow fading from one to the next album. Also behind the bar is a pair of vintage Western electric speakers, two Edison-looking tube amplifiers, plus tumblers, stemware, and glass coffee pour-overs. It's not yet clear ESP Hi-Fi, for now at least, is purely about listening and drinking, though there is popcorn in the back if you need some. By morning, it's coffee and tunes to match the sunlight creeping in. By night, the candles are at the menu are lit, and the menu turns to highballs, natural wines, vermouth, and Amari spritzers. Mintner and Foster like to talk about how they can set the tone for the room in one part of the day or another by adjusting record selection and levels. Their system creates a stereo sound rather than a room-filling presence, which is the main difference between the listening experiences here and at Sunday Vinyl. It means, depending upon where you're sitting, that the music takes on a live and in-person quality. It's a lifelike sound, like the musicians are right here in the room, Mintner said. The end goal is to feel like you're floating a little bit. And maybe because of this effect, Mintner says he's been pleasantly surprised to see the small crowds that gather at ESP on weekend nights staying put for a few hours, especially without food service. There are plans to add breakfast pastries by day, bread in small bites by night. A retail record or bottle shop could come later, as might more decor and even more sound studio treatment. But frankly, the rawness of ESP Hi-Fi makes it a little intoxicating. It's definitely not how a lot of people interact with a bar, especially, Mintner said, pointing out how the vibe from his favorite Japanese listening cafe will sometimes carry over to ESP. And that's something that's certainly welcome. We have a few people who come in, he said. They'll plop down in a hot spot and close their eyes and just listen. Workers at Kellogg's U.S. Cereal Plants Go on Strike by Josh Funk, the Associated Press. Omaha, Nebraska. Work at all of Kellogg Company's U.S. cereal plants came to a halt Tuesday as roughly 1,400 workers went on strike. But it wasn't immediately clear how much of the supply of Frosted Flakes or any of the company's other iconic brands would be disrupted. The strike includes plants in Omaha, Nebraska, Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Memphis, Tennessee. The union and the Battle Creek-based company have been at an impasse at the bargaining table for more than a year, said Daniel Osborne, president of the local union in Omaha. The dispute involves an assortment of pay and benefit issues such as the loss of premium health care, holiday pay, and reduced vacation time. And Osborne said the company has threatened to move some jobs to Mexico. A lot of Americans probably don't have too much issue with the Nike or Under Armour hats being made elsewhere or even our vehicles. But when they start manufacturing our food down to where they're out of the FDA control and OSHA control, I have a huge problem with that, Osborne said. The company insists that its offer is fair and would increase wages and benefits for employees that it said made an average of $120,000 a year last year. We are disappointed by the union's decision to strike. Kellogg provides compensation and benefits for our U.S. ready-to-eat cereal employees that are among the industry's best, Kellogg's spokesperson Chris Bonner said in a statement. Osborne said he expects the company to try to bring non-union workers into the plants at some point this week to try to resume operations and maintain the supply of its products. The company acknowledged that it is implementing contingency plans to limit supply disruptions for consumers. The plants have all continued to operate throughout the coronavirus pandemic, but Osborne said that for much of that time, workers were putting in 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, to keep up production while so many people were out because of the virus. The level we were working at is unsustainable, Osborne said. Kellogg's workers aren't the first food workers to strike during the pandemic. Earlier this year, more than 600 workers at Frito-Lay plant in Topeka, Kansas, walked off the job to protest working conditions during the pandemic, including forced overtime. That strike ended in July and workers ratified a new contract. Workers at Nabisco plants in five states went on strike in August to protest plans by Nabisco's parents, Mondelez International, to move some work to Mexico. Among other issues, according to the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers international union, which also represents the Kellogg's workers. That strike ended last month when the workers ratified a new contract. Mountain lion in Boulder tranquilized and relocated. Wildlife officials tranquilized and now relocate a mountain lion that was spotted in Boulder on Tuesday. Boulder police responded to Adams Circle off of 30th Street at around 8 a.m. after the lion was spotted napping on a wall. Colorado Parks and Wildlife officers responded along with Boulder Open Space Rangers, and they tranquilized the lion at around 9 a.m. and then loaded it into a cage. Colorado Parks and Wildlife spokesman Jason Clay said the lion was a young male that was only about 2 years old and that had likely just ventured out on its own. They're just trying to find their own place to be, Clay said. Clay said there were no reports of the animal getting into trouble, but the location was not an ideal spot for a mountain lion. As a result, the decision was made to dart it and relocate it to northwest Boulder County. Clay said otherwise the 100-pound mountain lion was in good health. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
A growing number of tents popping up in neighborhoods across Denver have made it harder to ignore a chronic and expanding housing crisis in Colorado and across the U.S. An initiative approved for Denver's November 2nd ballot calls for the city to crack down on campsites and to build sanctioned sites with running water, toilets, and lighting on public property. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says the proposal amounts to an empty promise because it fails to allocate land and other resources necessary to create safe outdoor spaces.
We know camping ban enforcements and extreme measures like the one proposed do nothing to resolve homelessness. They do not provide resources to get people into safe spaces and into housing.
Initiative 303, proposed by Garrett Flicker, chairman of the Denver Republican Party, would require written permission from owners to camp on private property, and the city would have 72 hours to respond to complaints. Denver currently is not enforcing a camping ban already on the books. A county court ruled that the law was cruel and unusual punishment in a case that could be taken up by the Colorado Supreme Court. If voters approve Initiative 303, Alderman worries enforcement will fall hardest on the city's most vulnerable residents.
Anytime you have an enforcement mechanism that is targeted at people experiencing homelessness, it is going to disproportionately impact those who are more likely to experience homelessness, which often are people of color.
Alderman points to a number of local, state, and federal proposals meant to reverse decades of disinvestment in affordable housing as a better strategy to end homelessness. She says if the city implements 303, it will actually take resources away from motel vouchers and other tools that are effective in helping people find their way into permanent housing.
So if the city is having to respond to every call about every tent, every time someone sees one, they're not going to be able to send people out to resolve issues. They're just going to be sending people out to move people around.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that anyone can apply for Health First Colorado, Medicaid, or CHP Plus benefits? Go to co.gov/PEAK, apply in person at your county of residence, or call 1-800-221-3943. Again, that phone number is 1-800-221-3943. TTY 711. Most Health First Colorado and CHP Plus members are automatically enrolled for dental benefits. Undocumented persons can apply for Medicaid or CHP Plus for their documented children. A Social Security number or legal permanent resident ID needs to be provided for the household members that are applying for benefits. The person completing the application is asked for their Social Security number, but it is not required. This message brought to you by DentaQuest, Administrator of Health First Colorado Medicaid, and the CHP Plus Dental Programs. For information about your DentaQuest dental benefits, finding a provider, to request a replacement dental ID card, or need help scheduling an appointment, Health First Colorado members call 1-855-225-1729. Again, that phone number is 1-855-225-1729. TTY 711, and CHP Plus members call 1-888-307-6561. Again, that's 1-888-307-6561. TTY 711, or visit us at dentaquest.com/Colorado. For replacement dental ID cards, Members can also create an account or log into the member portal at dentaquest.com/Colorado.
How do the blind get their newspaper headlines? By NFB Newsline, a revolutionary audio service. If you want to receive NFB Newsline, contact the National Federation of the Blind, 410-659-9314.